From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Healthcare, the law, and the politics. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The U.S. Supreme Court has found the Affordable Care Act constitutional, a major victory for President Obama. The decision was written by Chief Justice John Roberts, who sided with four liberal colleagues against conservatives, splitting the court 5-4. The mandate requiring all Americans to buy health insurance was upheld, but the majority called it a tax, and that gave Mitt Romney an opening. We'll hear about today's opinion and what it could mean for the availability of health care, the presidential campaign, and the powers of Congress. On Reporter's Notebook later on, the court also ruled it's okay to claim you've received medals for military service, even if that's not true. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld President Obama's Affordable Care Act, a short-term victory with long-term consequences for health care, the powers of Congress, and the presidential campaign. We'll talk about that today. On Reporter's Notebook, another decision on the court's last day of the current term, lying about military service may be contemptible, but it's also protected free speech. Chief Justice John Roberts joined the Supreme Court's four liberals against four conservatives today, upholding the Affordable Care Act that Republicans call Obamacare. The president was very pleased.
The highest court in the land has now spoken. We will continue to implement this law, and we'll work together to improve on it where we can. But what we won't do, what the country can't afford to do, is refight the political battles of 2 years ago or go back to the way things were. With today's announcement, it's time for us to move forward, to implement and, where necessary, improve on this law.
Later we'll hear that the political battles have been resumed in full measure. But first, let's talk with Noam Levy, who's healthcare reporter for the Tribune Company, including the Los Angeles Times. Noam, good to have you back on our program.
Thanks, Warren.
When the president says it's time now to implement this law, what is this decision going to mean and how soon for people who need care in the United States?
Well, you remember that a number of the states that were suing to challenge this law had effectively stopped implementing the law, saying we are not going to set up these new insurance exchanges where people are to be able to buy health insurance plans if they don't get them at work, and not work on expanding their Medicaid programs, which, of course, was a major part of the law. So by effectively upholding the law, in toto, the court essentially should clear away some of that. Presumably, some of these states will now move forward, because if they don't, there are provisions in the law that empower the federal government to step in and do it for them. So you may say that. Now, there's one caveat there, which I'm happy to go into, which involves Medicaid, because of a technical but potentially very important part of the court's decision.
Please do, because that was one of the major ways to expand the opportunity for people to get health care.
Well, that's right. I mean, half of the law, half of the expansion in coverage envisioned by the law was through Medicaid. This got a lot less attention, obviously, than the insurance mandate and the constitutional issues that were wrapped up there. But absent that Medicaid expansion, I think you could argue the law actually would be much more hobbled than if it had lost the insurance mandate. So what the law does is provide almost $1 trillion in federal aid to states over the next 10 years to help them enroll 16, 17, maybe more million low-income Americans into Medicaid programs. Now, Medicaid programs are, even though it's a federal program, they are run by the states, and over the last 50 years, they've sort of developed in different ways in the states. So some states have covered a lot more people than others. What the law did was say everybody's got to cover all Americans making less than 133% of the federal poverty line. So that was how so many more people were going to get covered. Now, what the court said was that the law cannot mandate that states do this. So that would presumably mean that a state could tell the federal government, no, we do not want to expand our Medicaid program, even though you are going to, you, the federal government, are going to pay for most of this. And that potentially opens up a window through which a lot of people could get left out of insurance coverage. Every state is going to have a choice to make. So states like California, Massachusetts, New York, states that have sort of embraced the law almost certainly will move forward. But another states that have fought it might make the calculation, look, yes, the federal government is paying for a lot of this expansion. They're paying for 100% of it in the first couple of years, then it goes down to 90%. There's still a cost associated with that for states. Maybe they don't want to pay the cost, even if it's relatively small. And maybe that cost will rise in the future. Who knows what the federal government will do, especially in this environment in which there's incredible amount of pressure to cut federal spending. Now, the one thing that would make a state like Texas, for example, might think twice about cutting that or declining to take that federal money might be pressure from hospitals and doctors and other providers. Many of those medical providers, which currently provide health insurance to uninsured people, do so at a loss. And there are provisions of the healthcare law which cut federal funding to, for example, hospitals over the next 10 years on the assumption that those hospitals will be covering, well, will providing care to fewer people who don't have insurance. If you're a hospital in, say, Dallas or Miami or a state where there's been a lot of opposition to the law, you're still subject to those cuts. If your governor then says, or your legislature says, well, we don't want the extra Medicaid money, we're going to leave those people uninsured, you kind of get whacked coming and going. You're going to lose federal money, and you're going to lose Medicaid.
All right, Noam Levy, one indication of just how complicated this decision is and how much it might mean to many people across the country. Noam Levy with the Los Angeles Times and the Tribune Company. Thanks so much, as always. In a moment, more on today's decision and its implications for healthcare, the law, and politics. To the point.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warren, I'll be back with To the Point. Now that the Supreme Court has spoken, as we heard, President Obama says there is no point in returning to the political battles of the past. Mitt Romney, standing with a view of the Capitol building in the background, effectively said today, they are the politics of the present.
What the court did not do on its last day in session, I will do on my first day if elected president of the United States. And that is, I will act to repeal Obamacare.
Dahlia Lithwick is senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com. It's always good to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me.
The court now, it gets technical, but I think it's very important. The court said that with regard to the Commerce Clause, the Affordable Care Act was not sustainable. What it ruled was that instead, requiring people to buy insurance is effectively a tax on them. And the Republicans now, including Mitt Romney, are saying that this just demonstrates that President Obama is a big tax and spender. So did the court give the Republicans something of a victory here?
A little bit. I mean, I think that certainly had the administration called this a tax from the get-go, we wouldn't have had 2 years of litigation, because we know that the tax powers are broad, and it was quite a deliberate effort to write it into the bill as a penalty and not as a tax, and that's how we got here.
The president has said again and again, this is not a tax.
That's exactly right. So, you know, in one sense, this is John Roberts saying, yes, it is a tax, and it walks like a tax, and it functions like a tax, and the IRS collects it, and therefore it's a tax, and now Obama's going to have to, I think, do some fast pedaling to say, no, it's not a tax, although, you know, I think already the message coming out of the White House is, look, we just said we wouldn't increase taxes. So I do think that in one sense this is a bit of a thumb in the eye to the administration, but I think in almost every other sense this is just seen as a big, big victory. This is John Roberts voting with the court's liberal wing to uphold the president's signature legislation and on pretty broad ground. So I think in the end of the day, Obama's probably not nearly as depressed as he might have been.
Mitt Romney says he's going to take action to try to get it repealed. The Republicans in the Congress are saying that's exactly what they want to do, and a measure will be introduced on July 9th when they come back to Washington. What are their prospects?
Well, you know, one of the paradoxes of this case has always been that while people hate the mandate and the mandate, you know, continues to pull abysmally badly, people really love many of the provisions of this bill. And so they love the idea that pre-existing conditions can't be barred from coverage. They love the idea that their kids can stay on their insurance till they're 26. So the real problem has always been that people hate the mandate and love the provisions. And I think when it comes to repeal, you're going to have the same problem, which is people hate the mandate, but you don't want to go taking away provisions that, as they come online, Americans are going to start to say, hey, maybe I really like this. So I think, you know, certainly that's the conundrum the Obama administration has had in defending the law. It will be the conundrum, I think, exactly the same conundrum in trying to repeal it.
Dahlia Lithwick, again, a senior editor and legal correspondent at Slate.com. Randy Barnett is a professor at Georgetown Law School. He was described by the Washington Post as the key legal thinker developing the case against the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Nice to be here.
Did you win or did you lose? They did say, with regard to the Commerce Clause, that effectively your arguments were right.
I was prepared to have my arguments accepted and win. I was prepared today to have my arguments rejected and lose. I was not prepared today to have my arguments accepted and then lose. this was very strange, actually, and I can't quite get my head around it. Every argument that we made against the constitutionality of the individual mandate under the Commerce Clause and the Necessary and Proper Clause, which was dismissed by my academic colleagues and others as frivolous for 2 years, was accepted by a majority of the court and affirmed by a majority of the court today. And yet, nevertheless, the Affordable Care Act was largely upheld.
Let me go back to Dahlia Lithwick. What do you say to that? You're on the other side from Randy Barnett in this argument over the Commerce Clause. Did he win one and at the same time lose one?
Well, I don't. I mean, I think that it's certainly the case that there were five votes at the court, and you heard it so strongly in Chief Justice Roberts' opening statements today from the bench that he absolutely believed that Professor Barnett was right in all the particulars, and that you know, you cannot force people into a marketplace, you cannot force them to purchase commercial products, you cannot regulate inactivity. So these were absolutely, you know, Professor Barnett is completely right. Those were the arguments being put forward. What happened was he then pirouetted, surprised everyone, and said, but I'm going to call it a tax. It's my obligation. He said it's the court's obligation to find some way to find a statute constitutional if we can. And here it is. And so I think that it is very hard, I think, for all of us to get around, our heads around what just happened, because the first half of the Chief Justice's comments looked very much as though he accepted completely Professor Barnett's arguments.
In fact, as some people reported, jumping the gun, based on those early remarks, that in fact the Affordable Care Act was going to be overturned, which of course it was not. Professor Barnett, what does this mean down the road in terms of the powers of Congress, particularly with regard to the states?
Yeah, well, when it comes to this mandate, one of the reasons why the Commerce Clause theory was so terribly dangerous is it meant that even though in this case only a monetary penalty was paid if you didn't buy insurance, if this were a commerce power, Congress would have every power of enforcement up to and including imprisonment if you violated one of its economic purchase mandates. By ruling that this is a tax, any future incentives that Congress comes up with in the name of a tax to get people to do what they want are going to be limited to monetary consequences for failure to do it. And that really is an improvement over the theory that Congress itself put forward for why it had this power.
So this means then down the road that the precedents with regard to the Commerce Clause may be changed a bit by this court? Is it moving in a different direction from where it's been going for the past 50 years?
No, I don't think that's true. I think since 1995, the Supreme Court has said that there are limits on the powers of Congress under the commerce power. People doubted that they were serious about that and thought that they had backed off of that after the Raich case, the medical marijuana case that I took to the Supreme Court. Today, the court reaffirms that those limits limits still exist and that this one particular exercise of power was beyond those limits. And so that's very important, but I don't think it necessarily calls into question any other laws that Congress has passed under the limits that currently exist.
All right. Professor Randy Barnett at Georgetown Law School, who won and lost, Dahlia Lithwick with Slate.com, where she's senior editor, also, of course, a legal correspondent and an attorney herself. Thank you both for being on our program.
Thank you.
Bye.
Jeffrey Stone is professor of law at the University of Chicago. He's author most recently of Speaking Out, Reflections on Law, Liberty, and Justice. He's a former dean of the law school, and he was a clerk for the late Justice William Brennan, regarded as one of the great liberals on the Warren Court. Jeffrey Stone, good to have you on our program.
Delighted to be here.
Where do you come down, or what do you make of the fact that it was Chief Justice Roberts with the liberals who ultimately allowed the Affordable Care Act to continue in effect?
Well, I think part of it is that Chief Justice Roberts has always been thought to be a serious lawyer and not only an ideologue. And to that extent, I think in this case, that side of him, at least to some extent, came to the fore. But beyond that, I think he was clearly making an institutional decision about the court, about politics, about the way the court is perceived, and about saving credibility. So had the court come out the other way in this case and voted 5-4 to invalidate the Affordable Care Act, you would have had five Republicans voting against the signature piece of legislation from a Democratic president, four Democratic-appointed justices supporting the law. It would have looked, again, extremely ideological, like Citizens United, like Bush versus Gore. And I think Roberts must have understood that would not stand the court in very good stead, particularly going into a presidential election. It would have looked extremely political and caused a good deal of doubt about the integrity of the court. And moreover, by doing this, he gives himself a high degree of credibility when it comes to some of the really bigger decisions in principle that are going to be on the court's agenda next year. For example, the constitutionality of Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act and the constitutionality of affirmative action. Those are both cases that could easily be 5-4 with five Republicans on one side and four Democrats on the other. And by voting the way he does here, I think Roberts gives himself an opening to do those decisions, which would be overruling major prior decisions of the court up to this point. So I think it's a very strategic decision on his part.
Jeffrey Stone of the University of Chicago. Randy Barnett still with us at Georgetown Law School. Does this go a long way to explain what you said was the sort of paradox of the fact that you won on the Commerce Clause but effectively lost the case because the law is still in effect? Does it have to do with the Chief Justice asserting his role in such a way as to maintain the credibility and integrity of the court in the eyes of Americans? Professor Barnett? Professor Barnett apparently has left us. Jeffrey Stone, back to you. Is that, in fact, what you're saying, that the Chief Justice was not just deciding the law, but also, as you indicated earlier, making an institutional decision that has a lot of political ramifications?
Yes, I think that's a significant part of what he was doing. And, you know, it's interesting. I became aware of what the result in this case was going to be a couple of days ago when Justice Scalia ranted at the on Monday in court about the immigration case. And although I knew Scalia was disappointed in that decision, that didn't explain the fury that he evidenced on Monday. And I think that what was clear there is that he was furious at what was going to happen today and at Roberts. And my guess is that Scalia is probably particularly upset with Roberts here because I think his view is Roberts must agree with him on the merits, but effectively reached the wrong result in this case because of reasons that Scalia finds illegitimate. So I think this is probably going to be a large rift within the court itself on this issue, as evidenced by Justice Scalia's anger on Monday.
Others pointed out that while Scalia was ranting, the liberals were kind of keeping a low profile and suggested that maybe that was because they were happy about the way the decision had gone in the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, I think that's probably definitely right.
What about the politics of it from your point of view, not just within the court, where you're obviously an expert as a former clerk for the late William Brennan, but in terms of Congress, what Congress is likely to do, of course, much will depend on how the campaign comes out.
Right. Well, Congress is not going to be able to do anything between now and January because you've got a Democratic Senate and a Republican House and a president who certainly wouldn't sign anything that did away with the Affordable Care Act. So realistically, it will depend on what happens in November. And, you know, my sense is that the only way that this legislation will be repealed is if Romney is elected and the Republicans gain control of not only gain control of the Senate, but have a filibuster-proof control of the Senate. That's not going to happen. So it seems to me that we're going to have this legislation with us for some time to come. And my guess is over time, people are going to come to understand that this is actually a very good thing for the American people. I think the real problem with this legislation is not the legislation. It's that the administration has done such a poor job of explaining it to people.
What do you think about the politics of the court again in the context of future decisions? If you could elaborate a bit on that, you said that there were several cases upcoming where this might, in fact, make a difference. Do you think that the decider, as Time Magazine called Justice Kennedy, is not going to be the decider anymore?
No, I think Kennedy is on most issues going to be the central justice. Given the general approaches of the other eight, Kennedy is most likely in many cases to be the central justice. And it's unusual for Roberts to be in that role in this case. And so I think that'll continue to be the case. In terms of the general politics of the court, you know, this is a court which is strongly divided between the Republican nominees and the Democratic nominees. And you've got really, I mean, to the extent that Justice Kennedy's in the middle is sort of funny in this environment because Kennedy is certainly the most conservative justice in the middle in the last 75 years. So it's an extremely conservative five and a fairly moderate liberal group of four. And as Justice Stevens said before he stepped down, you know, the court had moved profoundly to the right during the time he was on the court. So I do think this continues to be a very conservative court, despite today's decision. And I think Justice Kennedy will continue to be the justice in the middle of that court. And on the issues that come up next year, like the Voting Rights Act and affirmative action and possibly same-sex marriage, Justice Kennedy will play a critical role.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for being with us. Jeffrey Stone, University of Chicago, author of Speaking Out, Reflections on Law, Liberty, and Justice. It's good to have you on our program. Former dean of the law school and law clerk for the late Justice William Brennan. I know you're staying with us. We'll look forward to that as we take a break, and then we'll continue this conversation. Later on, we'll talk on Reporter's Notebook about the Stolen Valor Act. It's been overturned. Lying about military service is protected free speech. Back in a moment with To the Point from PR.
Subscribe to the To the Point podcast at kcrw.com or on the podcast page at iTunes. You can also find To the Point on KCRW's smartphone apps, now for iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry.
Warman Olney back with To the Point. Today's 5-4 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court has helped both sides define a major issue in the presidential campaign. And here again is President Obama.
I know a lot of coverage through this healthcare debate has focused on what it means politically. Well, it should be pretty clear by now that I didn't do this because it was good politics. I did it because I believed it was good for the country. I did it because I believed it was good for the American people.
And taking issue once more, Mitt Romney.
This is now a time for the American people to make a choice. You can choose whether you want to have a larger and larger government, more and more intrusive in your life, separating you and your doctor, whether you're comfortable with more deficits, higher debt that we pass on to the coming generations, whether you're willing to have the government put in place a plan that potentially causes you to lose the insurance that you like, or whether instead you want to return to a time when the American people will have their own choice in health care.
Again, Mitt Romney reacting to the president with the Capitol Dome in the background of the television location. He chose to make that where he chose to make that comment. Athida Scotchpole is professor of government and sociology at Harvard University, co-author of Healthcare Reform and American Politics. Good to have you on our program.
It's nice to be here.
Earlier in the program, it was pointed out that Americans hate the mandate, but they love the provisions, at least some of the provisions of the Affordable Health Care Act. They also hate the taxes. Has the court, by deciding this on the basis of the mandate being essentially a tax, given Mitt Romney a big opening to make a point in the presidential campaign?
You know, I really don't think so. I mean, the polling that I have followed very, very closely does not suggest that Americans in general are concerned about taxes being paid to make health care affordable and insurance workable for everyone. The tax that remains in this law, yes, the case labels it more clearly a tax, and we'll hear that word repeated about 50 times every time a Republican speaks about this law from now until November. But the truth is that the mandate only affects 6 out of every 100 Americans, and 4 out of the 6 get help from the credits and subsidies in the Affordable Care Act to buy health insurance. So this is an absolutely minuscule tax that will fall on a couple, 2 people out of 100, and it's unenforceable as the law is now written. So I think Republicans will be talking about it, but it'll be possible for Democrats to talk about all the other provisions of the law, which are popular with 60 to 70% of Americans, including majorities of Republicans. And if there is a detailed exchange, say in a presidential debate, Obama will be able to show, first of all, that this applies to practically nobody by the time all of the extensions of coverage are in place. And he'll be able to turn to Romney and say, why do you want to refuse to extend to all of America an approach that you sponsored in Massachusetts, which is working very well in that state and is very popular in that state?
What about the argument that $1 trillion is going to be spent in the next 10 years? That's going to make it impossible to deal with the deficit, which is another point the Republicans have been making today.
Well, there's no question that the 2012 election is going to be a kind of an Armageddon election about health care in general. It's really not going to be specifically about the Affordable Care Act because Mitt Romney has backed the Ryan budget plan, sponsored by, put forward on behalf of House Republicans by Congressman Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. And that plan calls for cutting funding radically on Medicaid and handing a complete responsibility for dealing with the poor and the disabled and the elderly to the states. And it also calls for turning Medicare into a voucher program in which people under age 55 would, in the future, after paying taxes all their lives into Medicare, they would have to shop for private insurance with vouchers of diminished value. So those are going to be the big budget issues and health care issues that will be debated in the campaign. Because basically the Ryan plan wants to save money on Medicare and Medicaid in order to pay for increased tax cuts for the very rich.
It is Scotchpole again at Harvard University. Rich Galen is a Republican strategist. He served as communications director for Newt Gingrich when he was Speaker of the House. He was not, however, supportive of the Gingrich presidential campaign that we saw fail so badly this year. Rich Galen, always good to have you back on our program.
Thank you. Nice to be back with you.
What do you say to Athida Scotchpole, who says the arguments as far as the Health Care Act are concerned really favor the president, not the Republicans?
Well, I mean, I we'll see. I mean, that's one of the reasons you actually hold elections, and that's the reason you actually hold campaigns. I'm not sure what polling the professor is looking at, but there is a poll that was released late last week or early this week from the Associated Press, and I'll quote from it briefly. Just a third of Americans and only a fifth of independents back President Barack Obama's health care overhaul in which the Supreme Court's about to rule. However, having said that, that same poll said that 77% of those polled wanted kind of a redo on the whole issue of health care. So the notion that somehow this is marvelously popular with huge swatches of the American public is simply wrong, at least according to that poll. Secondly, when she said that this will be an Armageddon election about health care, I just there's nothing to support that. I mean, everything that every poll that you look at has the economy and jobs as 1 and 2, and almost nothing as 3 through 10. And today's jobless claim numbers just add to that. So Larry Sabato, who's, as you know, a professor of political science down at University of Virginia, reminded everybody in a tweet this morning that this is June by November or by September when the two conventions are over. We'll all be focused on the economy, on jobs, and both sides will be pointing fingers at health care, substantially confusing the American public and not giving them a real choice on that because they don't want one.
Professor Scotchpole, back to you. The Republicans have been saying today that the Affordable Care Act, in fact, will cost jobs because it makes it less likely that companies will want to offer health insurance to people, or that if they do have to do it, they won't do any hiring.
You know, I need to go back to the question about polling because your guest has that wrong. It's certainly true that if you ask Americans in general about affordable care or about Obamacare, that more of them are opposed to it than support it. You have to keep in mind that about a quarter of those opposed wish that more were being done by government to help people with insurance. They are liberal dissenters. But the point I was making is absolutely borne out by all of the detailed polling on the particular provisions of Obamacare, the insurance rules, the subsidies to help businesses and families afford insurance if they can't do it now, and the state exchanges, the improvements in Medicare prescription drug coverage, the extension of coverage to 26-year-olds, the subsidies for small businesses. All of those are popular by 70%, 60 to 80%, roughly 70% majorities. And that detailed polling probably is known to your guest, but if it isn't, he needs to check out Pew and Kaiser that ask about the specific provisions of the health law.
What about his claim that there is no evidence that this is going to be an Armageddon battle over health care, because what it's really going to be about come November, when everybody's forgotten about this particular Supreme Court decision, it's going to be all about the economy?
Well, I do think that the election is going to be about the economy, and I do think that Obama will rise or fall according to what the German chancellor does with the European economy. But my point was simply that this is going to be a decisive election in terms of what happens with the funding of the major popular health care programs going forward, because Republicans and Mitt Romney are very clearly on record on behalf of very large cuts in Medicaid and a fundamental transformation of Medicare going forward. So it's a decisive election for the future of the funding of those health care programs.
Rich Galen, hard to argue with that, particularly given the Ryan budget, which has been supported by Mitt Romney.
Well, it's not a matter of just slashing for the sake of slashing. It's a function of looking for different ways to do it. I mean, I don't disagree with her position. I just think, I do disagree with the position. I don't think she's wrong. I just think that
okay.
I have a different view.
Let me ask you another question.
Let me finish.
Okay, sure.
It's really a question of how you score. Liberals and Democrats tend to score solely on how much money did we spend on this program. Any program, pick a program. How much money did we spend? Republicans and conservatives tend to score on how effective is the program, how effective can we make the program, and if you can actually make the program more effective and spend less money on it. I don't think there's much wrong with that, and that's, I think, the difference in philosophies.
I would just do want to raise a couple of issues with you, Rich Galen. We heard the candidate Romney say that somehow the Affordable Care Act separates you from your doctor and also causes you to lose insurance. Do you know how he gets to those conclusions?
Well, I don't know about the first part, but the second part, I mean, this thing was 2,000 pages long, and my guess is that of the three people on this call, only one of us has actually read the thing, and it's not me, that in terms of separating you from, or at least getting you, allowing you to choose your health care, is as we were talking about, if you go to, I'm on Medicare, so I mean, I get to sit on the curb here and watch the floats come by, but I think I would probably do better if, in fact, I could have a voucher and go shopping around to various publicly, you know, generally available health care plans and say, this is how much I get, what can you do for me, and let private insurance bid for my contract. I think that's fine.
So, Theodore Scotchpole, back to you. Is that then one of the things that's a strength of this program?
Which program are we talking about?
Well, if you get to shop around with these exchanges that are to be set up by the states, does that act in is that an argument you can make in favor of the Affordable Care Act?
You know, it's fine to give working-aged adults vouchers and give them a chance to choose among carefully regulated, honestly presented health care plans. That's what the Affordable Care Act will do for those proportion of people who aren't covered through their employer, which would be actually most people will continue to be. But let's just be clear about Medicare. It is beloved by the American people, 80 to 90%, including 70% of Tea Partiers. I wrote a book about Tea Partiers and interviewed grassroots Tea Partiers. And one very conservative Tea Partier told me that he liked Medicare precisely because he could pick his doctors and hospitals under that plan. To say to older people who insurance companies really do not want to cover, you've got to take a voucher that will have sharply diminished value because that's what the Ryan plan is, and go out and try to buy coverage. That is a death knell for large numbers of old people, or a budget buster for their children and grandchildren. That plan is really not liked by Americans, including Republicans. And to the degree that it becomes clear that that's what Mitt Romney and Paul Ryan have endorsed and Republicans have voted for, it's a big loser for them.
Let me go back to Jeffrey Stone again at the University of Chicago, where he's been dean of the law school, also former clerk for the late Justice William Brennan. One of the things that may be a fact in the near future is that there will be vacancies on the U.S. Supreme Court. How important do you think this case makes that fact in the presidential campaign? Do you think it'll be argued that by each of the candidates that they can appoint justices who might either retain the current balance on the court or drastically change it? Professor Stone? We have lost Professor Stone. Rich Galen, what do you think about that? Is Mitt Romney going to make an argument about the Supreme Court, or is that not the case?
Yeah, I think both sides will. I mean, we saw today as a great example of what happens when you appoint people for life, and in fact, the Chief Justice pointed that out, that it's not the court's job to rule on policy. People that have to stand for re-election have to do that. When you appoint somebody to the federal bench, generally, or to the Supreme Court in particular, it is a long-term process. And I think that it would be nice if somebody actually applauded George W. Bush for picking a guy like Mr. Chief Justice Roberts, who actually showed that he is indeed the scholar that he presented himself to be when Barack Obama voted against him.
Professor Scotchpole, it is true that Barack Obama voted against Chief Justice Roberts. It's also true that in this decision today, as we heard earlier from Randy Barnett, who was one of the principal people who formulated the argument based on the Commerce Clause, which he won with Chief Justice Roberts. So what about this issue that what he really wanted to do is advance the conservative agenda by at the same time maintaining the reputation and credibility of the court by giving up with regard to the Affordable Care Act?
Well, I found that argument by Professor Stone fairly credible, and I would just say that there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with the Chief Justice of the United States thinking about the institution that he leads. That's what they're supposed to do. That's why they're Chief Justices. So, of course, there will be activists in both parties who will think about Supreme Court appointments in this next election. But, you know, I really don't think that's what's going to be on the mind of most of the voters, especially in the middle and in the Democratic Party. I think that they're going to be thinking much more about jobs, the economy, and the various social benefits that are quite important to a lot of families in this country. I want to point out one more thing that we need to think about for the future, if you don't mind.
Quickly. Go ahead.
If the Republicans win everything in 2012, and there's a chance that they will, Mitt Romney and the Republicans will try to, they say they'll try to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They're not going to be able to do that. They will be able to defund it, to cut funding on it, to cut back on the funding of the Medicaid expansions and the subsidies for low-income and middle-income people to buy insurance on the exchanges. But notice the paradox that will result from that. The rules telling insurance companies that they have to take all comers will remain in place, but the money to help people buy the insurance company's plans will be cut back. That will create a pincer movement on the Republican Party that will be quite something to watch play out.
Okay, before we run out of time, Rich Galen, a response to that?
Yeah, well, when you're a Harvard professor, hope springs eternal, that Republicans will find themselves in a pitcher movement. I don't know that that'll happen. I don't know that any part of that will happen. I do know that in order to repeal a law, you have to pass a new law, and even if Republicans do win everything in November, they're not going to win 60 seats in the Senate. So it's not likely to go anywhere there anyway. So I do agree with the professor that the likelihood of this thing being repealed is about zero.
Okay. I do have to point out that the president himself also said, as have the Republicans, that it will have to be changed in some ways. Each side is going to want to improve it. So no doubt we will see what that means, perhaps not as the campaign goes on, but certainly once the election is over. Thank you both for being with us. Rich Galen, again, former Republican strategist for Newt Gingrich, or still a Republican strategist, not involved in the Gingrich campaign for president, but rather when he was Speaker of the House. Theda Scotchpole, professor at Harvard, thank you as well. And thanks to all of our other guests for being on our program today, too. The First Amendment protects the speech we detest as well as the speech we embrace. That is the reasoning in another decision that was handed down today by the U.S. Supreme Court. We'll hear about the Stolen Valor Act in a moment on To the Point.
Share your comments about today's show at kcrw.com/to the point or join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can also follow us on Twitter at @to_the_point_KCRW.
Marvin Ali back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. When Xavier Alvarez was a member of the Three Valleys Municipal Water District Board in eastern Los Angeles County, he claimed he was a former Marine and a recipient of the Medal of Honor. In fact, he had never served in the military at all. He was charged with and pled guilty to violating a federal law called the Stolen Valor Act. But his lawyers, even though he did plead guilty, appealed. Jonathan Turley is the Shapiro Professor of Public Interest Law at George Washington University. Professor, good to have you back on our program.
Thank you very much.
What happened after that?
Well, I guess Alvarez finally is something he can actually brag about, although I don't think many people will believe him. But he is responsible for a resounding win for free speech. The court ruled, upholding the Ninth Circuit, that criminalizing lies like those that he told is a violation of the First Amendment. And what's important to remember is that what the Congress was doing was to make a lie itself a crime. It actually has very little to do with medals of honor. In fact, one of the disturbing things about the dissent by Justice Alito and Thomas and Scalia is that they start out talking about the Medal of Honor as if there's some division in this country as to how we feel about it or the people that win them. It's not about that. That just happens to be the subject of the lie in the legislation. What the government was arguing is that Congress can criminalize a lie just for being a lie. We have lots of laws on the book that we constantly use to prosecute people for lies that gain them financial advantage, that they use to get something from other people. It's called fraud. But this was different. And so it went to the Supreme Court, and it was not a close vote. It was a 6-3 vote. And once again, John Roberts voted with the liberals and said, it's unconstitutional. The only thing about the decision that troubled some of us in the free speech community is that Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan wrote a concurring opinion that suggested that maybe a lower standard should apply, and also that other means might be used by Congress to reach the same end. But that didn't seem really to have much traction. The opinion itself is a great victory for free speech. But more importantly, you know, for weeks I've been telling folks that have asked me about this term that it was a shame that everyone's talking about immigration and health care, which have really sucked the air, the oxygen out of the room. This case, the Alvarez case, had sweeping potential to change lives of citizens. In the view of many of us on the free speech side, it would have gutted many of our free speech traditions.
Like what? What would we have lost had the Stolen Valor Act stayed in effect?
Well, the problem when you allow the government to criminalize lies for being lies is that you give the government also the authority to determine what is true and what is false. And the government routinely, and government officials routinely call people liars. They may be whistleblowers or reporters or political opponents. And what constitutes a lie is a dangerous thing to give to the government. Now, it's true that the government does prosecute people for fraud and for saying things that are untrue. But those are cases where you could show that someone used a lie to gain something from someone else financially. And so what we're left with is, you know, all of us agree with that people like Xavier Alvarez is a horrible person. But this would be a very heavy price for us to pay to try to nail these few individuals. This is not a widespread problem. Most of these people are self-identifying. I mean, Alvarez didn't just say that he won the Medal of Honor. He said he was secretly married to a Mexican starlet, that he played professional hockey with the Red Wings. You know, he was just a continual machine, a perpetual machine of lies. And nobody really believed it. And in what I've written on this in the past and looking at folks that have been nailed for this, you know, they're all pretty obvious. I mean, there's a big difference between people that disagree on how to describe a fact and these guys. I mean, these guys are just making something up entirely.
Should point out that Mr. Alvarez has resigned from the Three Valleys Municipal Water District Board. He did that after he was charged. I want to go back to Justices Breyer and Kagan. You said that you were concerned because they suggested that maybe a lower standard could be set or that other means could be taken to achieve the same goal. What is the goal? What was the goal of Congress?
Well, you know, all of the justices, as we all do, expressed support for the idea of combating these people. But what concerned me a bit was that Justice Breyer and Justice Kagan view that since these statements are false, they can be treated a bit differently from other statements. For people that are strong supporters of free speech, you often fear what's called a slippery slope, that is a standard that adds ambiguity free speech really needs a bright line rule. And from that, it means that we have to tolerate a lot of bad speech because we all benefit from a lot of good speech. And people like Alvarez, you know, no one's saying that this is good speech. And certainly no one's saying that this isn't an insult, not just to the winners of these medals, but to all of us. But these guys are, in fact, identified pretty well. In fact, the Internet, which is often viewed as a vehicle for lies, you know, people use anonymity to become incredibly cruel and often to say things that are untrue. But the Internet also serves a counterpurpose. You can go online and see who won the Medals of Honor. I mean, we had one guy who said he was a general. Someone just went on and looked at the list of generals and found he wasn't one.
Okay, so there are cases that are demonstrably false, such as this one. Then when you talk about the slippery slope, there are cases where what's true and what's false may be a matter of opinion, and the government ought not to be deciding that. I take it as where you're going.
That's right, and okay. I think it's a dangerous power to give a government.
Jonathan Turley, professor of public interest law at George Washington University. Thanks very much for coming back on our program.
Thank you very much.
Today's program produced by Sonia Geis with Katie Cooper and Gideon Brower. Our technical director is Phil Richards. Special thanks to Daniel Rothberg. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI. Public Radio International.